Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
Once again, we are wading through the torments of hell here. Yes, we are 6 into our 7 sin tour?
Yeah, we are.
And this time we're going to talk about something called wrath.
Oh, yeah, you know it.
Yep.
Maybe you have already felt it today.
Probably.
Several times.
For the most part, we're pretty wrathful people.
Yeah.
I mean, not just us. I'm talking about in general. We're wrathful beings in general. Well, we were just talking about this is why we both go to yoga, to sort of calm the
wrath. Tamp it down.
Yeah. Oh, humans are pretty wrathful. I mean, the thing about all these sins is that they are pretty intense in everybody. I mean, that's why they're the 7 deadly sins, because they're part of who we are. And from a religious perspective, they're things that we want to suppress. From just an everyday point of view, they're the kind of things we want to limit in our daily lives, because when they get out of whack, they can really wreck things up. But then also there's the question of, well, to what extent is this actually a virtue? Is this actually a good thing and a necessary part of who we are?
Right. So, is there an upside to anger, really?
Right.
But I suspect that Dante looked at wrath with a very unkind eye, because I was thinking about all these sins. This is one that can, as you pointed out, can be really destructive.
Yes, and as one is moving through Dante's Inferno, and again, this is the medieval classic Italian writer Dante, and in the tale, he is guided by his hero Virgil, who is a spirit at this point, because Virgil died long before.
In the Divine Comedy.
Yeah, in the Divine Comedy, leading him through hell, because he has to travel through hell to understand it, and then he has to travel through purgatory, and then he's going to experience heaven. But this all starts coming together for wrath in Circle 5 of the Inferno. Interestingly enough, this is right outside the Gates of Dis, okay? The Gates of Dis, like, if you think of Dante's Inferno, it's like a big pit.
Okay.
And at the bottom of the pit is the devil. And then scaling up the sides of this pit are all these various circles.
And it's like Dis.
Dis, like to diss somebody.
Yeah, I was going
to
say,
And the walls of Dis are, imagine a circular wall that is about, you know, maybe, well, not quite halfway, but maybe a third of the way down into this pit that, in theory, would, I guess, keep everything else from coming back up.
Mm-hmm.
This is like the bureaucracy of hell, and it separates the upper hell from the lower hells.
Good to know that there's bureaucracy in hell.
Yeah.
You know?
What's telling, though, is that Dante positions wrath just outside those gates. You go in the gates, you're going to start getting into what was in Dante's mind and in many medieval commentators' minds, more grievous sins, such as violence. That's worth noting. And violence may stem from wrath in many cases, but violence is dealt with in the lower hells, as are the more terrible things such as treachery, heresy.
So wrath is on the cusp of, you know, abstraction and then actual action.
Right. And what's interesting, too, about the way that Dante deals with wrath is in this circle, he includes both wrath and sullenness, okay?
Okay.
So you might imagine, just stereotypically, you might have drunken jocks picking fights in bars.
Mm-hmm.
Like, those guys are here, as are the sullen goths who just felt sorry for themselves.
Okay.
So, you know,
okay.
He views it as two forms of the same sin, okay?
It's the great unifier, too, apparently.
Right. Like, it all comes down to anger.
Mm-hmm.
And in wrath, anger is expressed. It's like, I'm feeling angry, I'm going to punch something, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's wrath. I'm feeling angry, I'm going to yell at something.
I'm feeling angry, I'm going to smoke a clove cigarette.
Yes, that's the other side. Yeah, because that is the sullenness. That's where anger is repressed.
Mm-hmm.
Some scholars argue that really Dante's dealing with sloth to a certain extent in the sullenness. But overall, this is a circle in which the passions of sorrow and grief end up ruling the soul. All right. So what does it look like? When we visit this particular circle, we find ourselves encountering a muddy swamp. Okay, this is the River Styx, and there's thick fog rolling across the surface, and Dante and Virgil are rowed across this by Phlegys, not to be confused with Charon or Tyrone, who rowed them across the Acheron on the very outskirts of hell.
Okay,
so this is a different dude. So they're rowing across this mucky, slimy, awful swamp. Like, I can't help but think the Bog of Eternal Stink from Labyrinth, you know?
Okay.
And as you look down into the swamp, first of all, you see bubbles rising up. And the bubbles are rising from the sullen. They are sunken down all the way to the bottom of the... They're just buried in the slime at the bottom of the river, at the bottom of the swamp. They're chanting. They're sort of singing mock hymns down there. So that's where the Sullen are.
Wow. But, and so, and like the sulfuric bubbles are like bubbling up from all of their pouting.
Right, right. They're drowning down there, bubbles rising up for this line. In life, they refuse to welcome the light of God, the light of sun, spiritual awakeness into their life. So in death, they're buried forever, gargling an endless hymn.
Mm.
So that's the Sullen. More of interest to us in this are the purely wrathful. And you'll find them at the surface of the water, wrestling with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So just imagine these naked forms writhing in the slime, like pigs in filth. They're punching each other. They're gouging. They're clawing. They're biting. And not just each other, but some of them are biting themselves. They're tearing at their own flesh.
It's like a really dark Abercrombie and Fitch commercial.
Yeah, I guess.
Because I imagine they're shirtless.
Yeah. They tend to be naked in the artistic interpretations. But then this is also interesting because Dante ends up seeing somebody he knows, this guy named Filippo Argenti. And Dante ends up encountering various people that he knew in life. That's a reoccurring theme in Inferno. And it's also a means by which he typically either shows some sympathy for the sinner or mm-hmm. some understanding of the sin and also identifies it in himself. There are various debates on who Argenti actually was. There's one account that it made, because Dante was banned from Florence at one point, lost his property and spent the rest of his life wishing he could return to Florence.
Mm-hmm.
And so one idea is that Argenti was somebody who ended up purchasing land that had belonged to Dante's family after he was driven out. So he may have had a personal axe to grind here with this individual, because Dante sees him and he's like, yeah, I hate that dude. I really would like to see him dunked under these waters before we're done here. And Virgil's like, yeah, just wait, it'll happen. And and then the guy, like, he sort of crawls up onto the boat and talks to Dante a little bit, but then the other people in the swamp end up tearing him apart, this Argenti character. So
do not cross Dante is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, but see, Dante was feeling wrath mm-hmm. himself. And so this is how he summons the emotion inside himself, even as he's seeing it in the torments around him.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much the Inferno version of wrath. In Purgatory, the souls purge themselves of wrath in a slightly different manner. And again, Purgatory, this is the Mount of Purgatory that rises from earth to heaven, that connects earth to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And it's when Dante eventually emerges from hell, he has to climb this mountain up to the terrestrial paradise and then into heaven. So if you find yourself on the terrace where wrath is dealt with, you'll find these individuals walking through thick smoke that's darker than the night. And they can't see the outside world. They're experiencing hallucinatory visions in which they see examples of meekness, which is the virtue that is opposite wrath.
Mm-hmm.
So you see this idea in Purgatory. Working through wrath is this thing that clouds our judgment and clouds our views of the world.
And I think that's such an apt description, because when you lose yourself to anger, that is exactly what it feels like, right? You
right.
cannot think clearly. All of a sudden you have trapped yourself into a corner in the situation and you're trying to get out of it.
Yeah, it's especially obvious after the fact with the little things that inspire our wrath.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're like, oh, well, this totally messed with my schedule today, and now I'm mad, you know? And then and then you feel, afterwards, hopefully, if you have any amount of self-consciousness about what you're doing and how your mind works, you look back on it and you're like, wow, well, that was ridiculous. Why was I upset?
But, right.
Of course, in its worst cases, it just completely, we end up hulking out, right? We end up harming things in the world around us.
Exactly.
Let me hit Buddhism real quick before we move into the science, though. I mentioned before how you have the Wheel of Samsara. This is the Wheel of Life that you see, especially in Tibetan Buddhism,
mm-hmm.
which shows all the various realms of existence in which a life may be born, which you can think of in terms of one life to the next. Like, I was bad in this life, so in my next life I'm occupying a harsher existence.
Mm-hmm.
Or, oh, I was good in this life, next life is going to be better. Or you can think of it in terms of my emotional state right now is this, and based on this emotional state, my next emotional state will be something else. You know?
Okay.
So it's like one state informing the other, or the way our consciousness evolves. But at the very center of this wheel, you find these three poisons, which I touched on before. You have a snake, a pig, and a cock. The snake represents hate, wrath. The other, the pig, is like delusion and ignorance, and the cock is greed,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes lust. But the snake is hate, and that's where we find the center of wrath that's moving the whole wheel that's just full of suffering. As far as the realms into which one may be reincarnated, and these are also realms that are in touch with the way humans feel in the state of our own souls, you have the Nakara realm, And this is the hell realm, the realm that's more typical of something you would see in Dante, full of hatred and torment and demons, the hell beings ripping people apart, that kind of thing. And that's in the lower realms.
Okay.
But then in the higher realms, you see the Asura realm. And this is the realm of the demigods, powerful beings. But despite their power, despite their freedom, they're not in the chains of Nakara. They're living it up. They're just one step below the gods. But they're defined by anger. They're defined by jealousy and war. And they end up wasting all this freedom and opportunity on the pursuit of power. So when they ultimately die, they live long lives, but they eventually do die, mm-hmm. then they're born down into the lower realms. So you see this interesting juxtaposition of the two states of being. And then, of course, there's the human realm in there, which is a balance of all these various realms. So you also have plenty of wrath there as well.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that the snake is the symbol of that, because it is sort of a, you know, you think about the snake swallowing itself. I think actually there's a medieval name for this.
Yeah, it has various names. I can't remember the one you're thinking of. Offhand, where the snake is biting its own tail, consuming its own tail.
Yeah, yeah.
And you get into, you know, ideas of the world serpent, the Jörmungandr.
Exactly, the Jörmungandr. But, you know, there's this idea that you're inflicting hurt upon yourself, right? And so I think it's interesting now to take that knowledge and turn it over to what's happening in your brain.
Yes.
When you're suffering a bout of anger, I guess you could say. Oddly enough, I want to point out that L-dope does not show up on the scene here.
Dopamine?
Yeah. It's been with us for so long that I thought for sure that it would be prominent in this, but it is not. It is really a story about the amygdala.
Well, I mean, it's probably there in the cocktail somewhere, but it's not playing a vital role.
No, you're right. Yeah. You're right. It's just, it's a bass note.
Yeah.
Or maybe I should say it's a top note. It's a fruity top note for some people, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But, yeah, it's a story about the amygdala, which helps us to process emotion. We've talked about this quite a bit before. And in the case of anger, it works in tandem with a number of biological responses, including the release of adrenaline. So it kind of makes sense, right? Because whenever you've experienced anger, wrath, I'm sure that you've had a moment where you just felt a surge of energy.
Mm-hmm.
It's that tension energy. That's because when we get angry, within a quarter of a second, the amygdala can serve up an action inspired by wrath, if it weren't for the frontal lobe. Because this is sort of our seat of reason, and this area of our brain also experiences a flow of blood, an attempt to sit there and kind of weigh the situation and the response. And altogether, this process can take just 2 seconds, right? So if there's a trigger that makes you angry, just within 2 seconds, you could be serving up a punch, or you could be trying to restrain yourself. And this is really why people often say, you know, count to 10 if you're angry.
Yeah.
Because it gives you a chance to kind of pull your adrenaline-addled self together.
Yeah, or if you're one thing that I've practiced in the past and also told other people, it's like if you have that angry email you really want to send, go ahead and write the email.
Don't put the two in the field, though.
Yeah, don't put the two in the field. Yeah, go ahead and write it. Maybe just write it in a text document, then shut it down and let it sit for a while.
And it's true. Like the next day, you could go back to that and be like, oh, man, that was just a fool's errand right there.
Yeah, well, what was I doing with that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't help but think of it in terms of like the amygdala and the frontal lobe. It's like the amygdala is kind of like the, you know, the classic image of the devil on one shoulder and the angel on the other. Instead, though, imagine like a pro wrestler on one shoulder and like a Buddhist monk on the other. And the pro wrestler is the emotional amygdala, and it's like, go out there, do it, get angry. Don't take this stuff off anybody. Punch, write angry emails. Stomp around, huff and puff. And then on the other side, you have the Buddhist monk, and the Buddhist monk is like, let's chill it out. Let's think logically. Let's think calmly about this. But you have to depend on that monk having enough energy to put up with the amygdala, because sometimes the amygdala is going to be, all right, let's do it. Let's crack some heads. And then the monk's like, you know, I'm done. I'm going to beat here.
Well, you know what? And there's a couple of things that could actually weaken your inner monk response.
Yeah.
By the way, I really like this idea of both of them, like the monk and the wrestler, because they're both wearing robes. In my version that I see on your shoulders right now. But a couple of circumstances. One is you could have sustained damage to your frontal lobe.
Yes.
Like our poor friend Phineas Gage, right? This is the guy who in 1948 was working on the railroad, and when he was excavating rock and he was tamping gunpowder down in a drill hole, and there was an accidental explosion which caused the tamping iron he was using to thrust itself through his left cheek and out his skull.
Yeah, like out his, like completely through his head and then in the air on the other side. It basically gave him a frontal lobotomy.
Yeah, yeah. And he survived it, but what happened is he became childlike and became bullying, and he started to use profanity. Again, this is 1848. So this guy went from mild mannered to like crazy town in very short amount of time. And they didn't understand enough about the brain at the time to really attribute that to his accident.
Yeah, and by the way, if you want to hear more about Gage and other things of this nature, we did a podcast, Change Your Mind the Hard Way, where we dealt with some of these things.
Another circumstance is serotonin.
Yes.
Your serotonin levels. There was a study conducted by the University of Cambridge, and this was actually reported in a Science Daily article. They talked about healthy volunteers, and what they did is they took these healthy volunteers and altered their serotonin levels by manipulating their diet, because we know that your diet can affect the serotonin levels in your brain and make you, you know, really sort of regulate your mood.
Yeah, there are certain foods that are going to be high in serotonin. And if you've ever been to a health food store and looked around at supplements, there are obviously a lot of serotonin supplements that are aimed at helping you out with your serotonin level.
And, you know, we've talked about this in the past, too, especially with our podcast on decision fatigue. Just make sure that you're getting enough to eat, you know, throughout the day, because that really does affect your ability to regulate your moods.
Yeah, you are what you eat, but you also are what you think. So the two come together.
That's right.
Eat to think.
Don't, mind, body.
Don't eat to live, but eat to think.
That's on my bumper sticker on my car. What they did, they manipulated their diets. On the serotonin depletion day, the volunteers were given a mixture of amino acids that lacked tryptophan, the building block for serotonin. And on the placebo day, they were given the same mixture, but with a normal amount of tryptophan.
Okay.
And then the researchers scanned the volunteers' brains using fMRI. And as the volunteers viewed faces with angry, sad, and neutral expressions. And then they were able to measure how different regions reacted and communicated with one another when the volunteers viewed the angry faces as opposed to the sad or neutral faces. So the research revealed that low brain serotonin made communications between specific brain regions, we're talking again about the amygdala and the frontal lobe, much weaker. And the findings actually suggest that when our serotonin levels are low, it may be really much more difficult for the prefrontal cortex to control emotional responses to anger. This is kind of a dumb moment, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, you know what? When I was angry, I was really hungry and I was tired and
hangry even, right?
I was hangry.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that the serotonin levels could affect our mood like that.
So to put it back in terms of the pro wrestler and the monk mm-hmm. on your shoulders, in the case of Phineas Gage, the monk was just completely taken out by a rod. In the case of the serotonin issue, the individual hasn't had enough to eat or for whatever reason, their serotonin level has dropped,
mm-hmm.
and so has the communication between the two. So the pro wrestler is on one shoulder saying, let's do it, let's go out there and let's kick some butt. I'm not going to take this anymore. How dare they do this to me? And the monk is like yelling across a chasm here and saying, hey, calm down. And the pro wrestler's like, what? What's he talking about? And then launches back into
the thing, too. Let's say that you are a person who has two pro wrestlers on your shoulder.
Ooh.
In other words, you are prone to be more aggressive and therefore more prone to anger. Your communications between your amygdala and your prefrontal cortex are going to be weakened regardless.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have the depletion, it's much more pronounced.
What's interesting about this, and I was reading this experiment as well, where they referred to them as the short fusers and the brooders.
Mm-hmm.
So the short fusers, that's the guy who's like, oh, you took me off, I'm going to punch somebody in the face.
Yeah.
And then you have the brooders who are like, oh, that person really made me mad, I'm going to pretty much be miserable the rest of the day. Which brings me back to thinking about Dante with the sullen and the wrathful. So I wonder if you could look at the short fusers are the ones tearing each other up and punching everyone in the face on the surface of Styx, the river Styx. And then the brooders are the sullen, buried in the muck at the bottom, gargling their hymns into the slime.
Yeah, the pouters just need to meditate, and the short fusers just need a sandwich. Because really,
to simplify things,
absolutely. But really, if you are a short fused person, you really are much more sensitive to your serotonin levels,
mm-hmm.
is what this is spelling out. So it is very important to try to get that sandwich in your belly, really. Again, to simplify it.
In fact, there have been experiments where if you actually look at the brain and you scan it and you see what's lighting up during these moments of wrath or when there's some sort of stimuli that provokes wrath, you can see the difference between short fusers and brooders in seconds. The medial prefrontal cortex associated with self-awareness and emotional regulation quickly lights up with the brooders. So does the hippocampus involved in memory.
Mm-hmm.
So as they fume, people repeatedly relive the events in their mind. It's like they're chewing over that thing that made them mad.
Yeah, yeah.
They're continually tweaking that story in their head about that thing that happened to them that was sucky, and now they're mad.
So anger can be so fleeting, right? It can be such a flash. Like, how long is this taking, this whole process?
It's just taking seconds. They found in this experiment that the degree of hippocampal activation predicted how much people tended to ruminate. So you could actually see, depending on what the hippocampus is doing, you can tell how much they're brooding on the anger.
I'm imagining a little sign on the fMRI that says, need sandwich, and it's just like flashing over the prefrontal cortex. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about whether or not you could be attracted to anger.
All right, we're back. So, wrath, to what extent is it attractive? I mean,
not so much. Usually people go out of their way to avoid people who are angry, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's often referred to as showing one's butt.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, more or less. They're like, oh, I really showed his butt on that one, right?
Right.
Well, they tend not to say butt, but you know what I mean? It's generally like they let wrath take control of them, and they really kind of look like a fool for it.
Right. You now know their emotional address. You know where they live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you think of wrath, and you think of there's so many things in our culture where wrath is celebrated. It involves creating a fictional or just creating even real-world circumstances that allow the wrath to manifest in a way that is either acceptable or relatable.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Incredible Hulk, you know? This is an example where mild-mannered Bruce Banner, he's getting kicked around, and then the rage gets a hold of him, right? And he turns into Hulk and starts kicking butt. Or just any masculine, testosterone-fueled action flick where the baddies are bad, and so our hero is even badder and starts just wailing on people, you know, Bruce Lee type stuff.
Right.
We do get something out of that. There's something appealing about that on various levels. I mean, you can break it down to the viewer of some sort of film like this. They have issues in their life that they would, on some level, like to be able to deal with in a direct manner. And so I'm going to watch something or play a game in which somebody deals with their problems with direct violence.
Well, right. And there are some people who do bait other people in order to raise their hackles, right?
Yes.
And get a little charge of anger because they're interested in provocation, right? And getting into a fight.
Yeah. And I feel like this is interesting because I think we've all done this, or maybe not all, but most of us, I feel like, have felt this at one point or another, where you're not necessarily like a complete bully or anything like that, like nothing like really heinous, but where you're just sort of poking at somebody just to get, like, you know, the little things that might annoy your significant other. And if the mood is right, you might just pry him a little to see if it
okay.
gets a tackle.
So could it be that on that day, your testosterone levels were higher than they usually were?
Quite possibly.
Right. This is for both men and women. University of Michigan psychology study found that some people find angry expressions rewarding. And they actually interpret it as rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
Testosterone levels were actually measured in a group via saliva samples. And then this group was asked to work on a learning task that involved a flash of images, some with angry faces, some with neutral faces, and some images containing absolutely no faces. And the images flashed by so quickly that the participants weren't really able to detect a pattern. In fact, though, this task that they were working on was really to gauge whether or not they could subliminally work out a pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And it was found that men and women with high testosterone levels learned the sequence of key presses better when the sequence was followed by an angry face. And the conclusion is that the anger expressions were rewarding to the brain, and that's why they had a better memory of this.
That's interesting. That reminds me of this article we were looking at from Wired that was talking about Steve Jobs.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was like the Mobile Me portion of the original, the first iPhone came out. iPhone comes out, everyone loves it, but Mobile Me doesn't work.
I mean, it's supposed to be, you know, on par with BlackBerry's
right.
Applications and, you know, it's supposed to actually fill that need.
Right. It was an important part of the product. And Jobs was notoriously perfectionist. He had a certain vision. He wanted to see that vision brought to life.
And he was known for having steam coming out of his ears all the time.
Right. And interestingly enough, he practiced Buddhism.
I know. I was just thinking about that, too. Yeah.
But, I mean, he probably realized that, hey, I need to... I mean, I understand he did realize that maybe this anger needs to be treated in some parts of my life. But maybe not when it came to Mobile Me not working. Because he lined everybody up. Got him into the theater there, and just continued to, like, lay into him for...
I think for, like, a solid hour.
A solid hour.
Can you imagine
that? Just
like,
thrash them.
Yeah.
I mean, not physically, but just let them have it.
Tongue lashing.
Told them that they should all hate each other for what had happened.
They had brought dishonor to the brand.
Yeah, like, basically telling them that they are the beings in the River Styx, and they should just tear each other apart because they have...
Well, and they should commit, you know, mental Harry Carey,
yeah.
you know? But, yeah, I mean, here's a good example of...
I mean, it's the ultimate, like, it's the kind of like negative feedback that we all rail against whenever we encounter even like a little bit of it, you know? I mean, nobody likes to be in trouble. Nobody likes a working environment where somebody's on your case for something. It makes you angry. It makes you, you know, makes you sullen, makes you kind of hate your job. But some of the evidence lines up to support the idea that it also inspires you on some level, that it actually, you're angry, sure, but then you're committed to getting it done.
Okay, so to that end, I have to read this quote from the co-author of the University of Michigan Angry Faces study, because I think of Steve Jobs now. He says, quote, "It's kind of striking that an angry facial expression is consciously valued as a very negative signal by almost everyone, yet at a non-conscious level can be like a tasty morsel that some people will vigorously work for."
Hmm.
So, I don't know, maybe there were people on Jobs' team who actually responded to that.
Well, I mean, the thing could be he knew his team well.
He
knew that these are guys that will
and
respond.
Women.
And guy, yeah, well, I'm using guys in the gender neutral sense.
Yeah.
These are guys who realize, see, now you're irritated by that. I saw
I'm not irritated. I'm actually amused.
Okay. But maybe, he realized that this is a crowd that is stimulated by that. And a Wired writer or somebody commenting on the outside, or they're not a part of that group. And maybe they're more of a positive reinforcement environment. It's easy for us to comment on that because I feel like here at How Stuff Works, aside from the days where Jerry comes to the halls with a bullwhip, like physically with a bullwhip and hits everybody.
Right.
Aside from those days.
Or Matt just gives us the occasional dressing down.
Yeah.
Just for fun.
Yeah. Aside from that, it's a pretty positive place to work. It's more about positive reinforcement, brainstorming, that kind of thing. Brainstorming, of course.
Well, in our mother.
The environment where there are no wrong answers. There are no bad ideas in brainstorming, though I have heard a few.
and our mother company, Discovery. I mean, it's all about, you know, everybody wearing the lovey-dovey pants.
Yeah.
Which is pretty nice.
I need to get some more lovey-dovey pants because I split them the other day.
Yeah. In fact, didn't we got something about a flash mob here? Occurrence happening because, well, anyway,
I wasn't sure if that was actually happening or if that was an example.
I think that's
that
an example
happen.
Of things that can happen during a brainstorm.
Okay.
So anyway, that is another story for another time, but let's talk about when you are in a chronic state of anger.
So
you're on Jobs' team, and let's just assume that all the time is all anger. It's not going to be, of course.
But you do encounter people like this where you're like, man, they are angry all the time.
Yeah.
They're just constantly fuming over every little or big thing in their life.
Yeah, well, the state of response can start to take a toll on you, obviously. Chronically angry people may not produce enough acetylcholine. Hopefully I've said that right. A hormone which tempers the more severe effects of adrenaline. And their nervous system is constantly working and can eventually become overtaxed, leading to a weakened heart and stiffer arteries.
Yeah, this incidentally was the first neurotransmitter discovered, isolated in 1921 by German biologist Otto Loewi, who would later win the Nobel Prize for his work.
Yeah, and it's really important because there's all sorts of potential for damage, not just the heart, but the liver and the kidney, as well as having high cholesterol.
Yeah, it's responsible for much of the stimulation of muscles, including muscles in the gastrointestinal system, and it's also found in sensory neurons and in the autonomic nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a part of scheduling even REM sleep. So.
Okay, yeah. And if you think we're kidding about this, just pull out one more stat. In a 2001 study of 13,000 subjects, people with the highest levels of anger had twice the risk of coronary artery disease and three times the risk of heart attack as compared to the subjects with the lowest levels of anger.
See, this makes it even harder for me to watch Lewis Black these days. You know?
Really?
Yeah.
Because you feel
his whole shtick is like, I'm so angry at these things in the world that are not right. It's a great bit. He's a very talented comedian. But as he gets older, I'm kind of
right.
It's hard for me to watch him on The Daily Show because I'm like, this is not good for your health, Lewis. You gotta chill out. Like, I mean, maybe I don't know a lot about Lewis Black, so maybe to a large extent is an act. I mean, he's a professional, but I feel like he is summoning some real anger when he's
demons,
when he's performing, and I don't want to watch him keel over.
Okay, so assuming he's not in that state all the time, he's just kind of doing it as part of his shtick, it actually could be an upside for him.
Okay.
Okay, so, and actually for all of us, there could be an upside for anger. Again, assuming that this is not something that we're playing into and playing into the destructive, violent forces. I mean, there's a way to actually be constructively angry.
Yes.
Yeah. What they found, some folks who like to poke around in studies, actually researchers Mathis Baas, Karsten de Drew, and Bernard Nistad, They published the results in the Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, found that participants who were made to feel angry and then were asked to brainstorm exhibited key hallmarks of creative brainstorming, including unstructured thinking. And in a comparison to their counterparts, identified as sad or neutral people, the very angry participants came up with more ideas as well as more original ideas. And now this was a short-lived window, right? Like it didn't, they couldn't sustain this. Obviously, they couldn't sustain their anger as well, which was a good thing. But right after they were made to feel a bit of wrath, their brain was basically kind of unfettered and not thinking systematically.
Huh.
And this is where people think that anger could be really helpful, because you are getting that surge of adrenaline and you do become laser focused in the way that you want to remove an obstacle, or you're sitting there saying, how could this be? How can I make this better?
Huh.
And if you actually point that anger at the solution rather than, say, the person or the thing, you could make some headway and be really productive.
Huh. I believe the same study, or maybe this was a different one, that was talking about how sadness, sullenness, if you will, can also have, you know, it's bad in the short term,
but in the
long term,
yeah,
it can also, it also leads to increased creativity, increased drive. In your work.
Yeah, and was some of this too that people who may be depressed, although, and we've talked about this, it can hamper creativity at points, but there's some of this is tied to self-actualization, or being able to see yourself in a realistic light, and then be able to deal with obstacles in a long-term way, because you're not at that very moment sort of fooling yourself into, like, I can do this.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a little bit of a depressing way to put it, but yeah.
Well, it reminds me of most guys, anyway, really love the first one or two Batman movies, right? The Nolan films, not the...
Yes.
Yeah.
Some of the ladies.
Some of the ladies. Mm-hmm. I don't know. My wife doesn't like them. But,
okay.
But these are very much a product of a time during which, in the United States, you have the Bush administration, which, being a conservative administration, was generally, by and large, not as popular with liberal artistic types.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have war, you have economic downturn. Well, the economic downturn really comes after the Bush administration. But the same era, you have a lot of negative things going on, but you see the art that rises up out of these issues, out of this pain. I guess it's kind of like a nice, well, it sucks that there was a big war. It sucks that it lasted forever.
Mm-hmm.
But hey, we got some cool art out of it, right?
Well, I think what you're saying is that anger is mobilizing.
Right.
So
it forces us to get out there, think creatively, and say something.
Well, and I was thinking about that in terms of protests, too. I mean, there's a point where protests are really productive, right? And then there's a point where they can become very destructive, or, you know, devolve into violence.
So you're saying you don't have high hopes for the third Batman movie from Christopher Nolan?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that done well, anger can be really helpful, right?
Well, yeah, I mean...
But again, you have to bring a bit of mental energy to it to say, how am I reacting to this at this very moment? And that's where that 10-second cooling off period is really important. Because if you just let that 2 seconds rule you, you know, you could get a hammer to the head.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you look back and just think about it evolutionary, you can imagine this primitive human out on the prehistoric plains. He's killed a deer or something, right? And then there's this other dude coming along that's going to... try and eat his deer. That raises his hackles. He's like, who's this guy think he is trying to steal my deer flank out from under me?
Mm-hmm.
And then that anger can be used to mobilize him to fight for and keep what is his and what his survival depends on.
And although he's not quite that sophisticated yet, one day he will use that wonderful neocortex and he'll work out his problems via communication, words, in a way that he can say, let's not fight about this. Let's come to the logical conclusion about whose flesh this is.
Okay.
Right? That person will redirect his anger into a productive way. Now, you look like you're not buying
that. No, I'm buying it. I'm buying it completely. I mean, I think the interesting thing about wrath, like all of these sins really, is that there is a level where it makes sense and is a motivating force in life. And then there's that tipping point where it becomes something horrible and to be avoided. I don't know, but maybe it seems like with wrath, that the tipping point occurs a little sooner.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
I mean, there are levels of anger, right?
Yeah. So there you have it. Again, this is just one episode in a series. So as you're listening to this, feel free to go back and explore our previous 5 episodes. And there's also a good chance that you're listening to this in the future. Well, you're obviously listening to it in the future. So the final episode on sloth may also be out as well by the time you hear this.
That's right.
All right, let's call the robot over and read a quick listener mail. What have you got for us, Arnie? All right, this one comes to us from Michael. Michael writes in response to our episode, Stendhal Syndrome, Kicked in the Brain by Art.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I had no idea this was a thing. A few years ago, when I was in college studying design, my art history class went to the Tut exhibit. I was walking through, browsing at the pieces, disappointed that Tut wasn't even there, when suddenly I felt the knee... Oh, I thought he was going to be like, and then suddenly I felt a hand
His
on
touch.
My shoulder.
Yeah.
When suddenly I felt the need to stop and look up, I saw the crook and flail on display. I lost my breath. The room spun and all of the commotion disappeared. It felt like I was hallucinating. I swear that I was looking up at a pharaoh holding them. And these are, of course, the two instruments mm-hmm. that a pharaoh, a mummified
Hands
pharaoh, may hold mm-hmm. across their chest. I was completely paralyzed for what seemed to be hours until someone bumped into me. It was really crowded. It was then that I realized how old and beautiful the crook and flail were that I was looking at. It was so very overwhelming. I had forgotten about my childhood love of all things Egyptian. I didn't want to leave the room. I wanted to get closer, but there were too many people. I nearly cried at the sight of it, and I am not the overly emotive type. Wild stuff. Thanks for the great episode. I listen to each and every one.
Cool. Yeah, that's an awesome description of what Stendhal syndrome is, right?
Yeah, yeah. We discussed in that podcast how there are a number of different things informing it. It's not something where it's like, oh, there's something broken in my brain. It makes art pound me mm-hmm. whenever I look at it. But like, here's a great example of someone who came into the exhibit with certain
expectations,
but also this past, mm-hmm. this emotional past with the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're standing in front of it. This thing that maybe existed only in their mind before is manifest before them, and it's ancient and it's beautiful, and it just overwhelms them. So,
you know, I was just thinking that this reminds me of an article that was recently published in the New York Times called The Thin Places, or I think that's an approximation of the title, but it talks about how when we go on vacations, it doesn't have to be a vacation, it could be a park, it could be a special place, but it's perspective changing, and they call it the thin place because it occupies a place between earth and heaven.
Ooh, so it's like the places where reality grows them and the
yes.
spirit world pushes in on it.
Yes, and it takes you outside of yourself.
Yeah.
That's just... And one of the things that a museum can do to your brain, right?
Yeah. Well, it reminds me, in R. Scott Baker's fantasy books, there are these places that are basically the thin places. But the other thing about that is that madness can seep in from the outside. So, which seems to fall right in with Stendhal syndrome.
Yeah, yeah.
We encounter these thin places where art can affect us and can maybe drive us a little temporarily mad. So.
Well, it's like Jill Bolte Taylor, who had the stroke, and she started to see her own molecules melding with her environment, you know?
Wow.
I mean, it's not that extreme, but that's sort of a metaphor for what's happening. But anyway, you know.
Yeah, but that's awesome. Thanks for sharing that with us. Sydney, maybe. It was the emails from Michael, but it's signed Sydney, so... Michael/Sydney, thanks for sharing. And we'd love to hear from anyone else who's had an experience like that with something, with art, with history, etc., that they've encountered. And likewise, let us know what your experience with wrath is. How do you deal with it in your daily lives? How do you experience it in other people? And how do you mitigate it? To what extent does wrath actually inspire you to great things? And to what extent does it seem to hold you back? You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter. Check in with us that way. Share stuff with us that way. On Facebook, we are Stuff to Blow Your Mind. And our Twitter handle is Blow the Mind.
And you can always send us your thoughts via email at blowthemind@discovery.com. Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow.